C.S. Lewis was a great mind and man, and there's three things about him that make him interesting. One is he was a great academic. He was, you know, one of the great professors and scholars of literature in the 20th century. Another one was he was probably the foremost Christian apologist in the 20th century, and his books are delightful. They've been read by millions of people all over the world, and they're still read all the time. And the third one is he can reveal things to us about our time. It has special features, both of opportunity and great danger. And the specific thing I talk about in this series, a book called The Abolition of Man, is the place where he makes that most explicit. Hello, this is a course, an introduction to C.S. Lewis, who was a wonderful man. My name is Larry Arn. I teach and work here at Hillsdale College. This is going to be fun and difficult. C.S. Lewis was a simply delightful man. Millions of people have read his book. He's famous as a Christian apologist. My own opinion is not surpassed in modern times. His books are delightful, simple, and lovely. He wrote children's books, three of which, I think, now have been made into movies, the Narnia Chronicles. In the Second World War, in the year 1941, he gave a series of radio broadcasts, and they were, at the time, the most popular thing on British radio in history, except maybe for the wartime speeches of Winston Churchill, and they were published in a book called Mere Christianity. And that's a tremendous thing to read, and millions of people have read it in many countries. It's hard to do because C.S. Lewis was two other things in addition to being this popular, wonderful, delightful, hilarious, vivid, informative Christian apologist. C.S. Lewis was also an academic, very serious academic. He was a professor of literature at Oxford for most of his life, and then he was the first professor of medieval literature at Cambridge. He wrote very serious books about especially medieval and Renaissance literature. Those books are very worth reading. I have read two of them. I'll mention one of them in particular called The Discarded Image, an introduction to medieval and Renaissance literature that's just delightful to read. And his academic books are, of course, different in kind than the kind of books that he wrote for millions of people, although my opinion is they're very good. And the third thing C.S. Lewis was an analyst or commentator on our time. He thought that there were special features of our time, just as Winston Churchill thought that there were, and I argue that he thought that he saw those in the same light as Churchill. And so he wrote a lot of things that can sort of teach you where we are, and Lewis is explicit in many of his writings, you're going to learn in these lectures, about the need to do that. Lewis thought that it was very important to read history and great literature, especially from other times. And the reason is that you learn something about your own time, and our time is different, he thought, in certain ways. This book that I'm going to introduce this course by talking about and also conclude it, it's called The Abolition of Man, and it presents special difficulties because it's sort of a bridge between the academic and the popular writings of C.S. Lewis. It's a very serious argument. It's a short book. There are three chapters in the book, and the book is actually one long, sustained argument. It starts with an initial point about something he notices in an English literature book for school boys and girls, and it ends with the statement that one sentence in that little book, taken to where it's going to go if it's allowed to reign, that's just this one sentence, will result in something more than the loss of freedom and civilization, which go together. It will result in the abolition of man. And so to understand the book is to understand that argument. Why does he say that? And that argument goes on for about 90 pages in three chapters. And so I'm going to try to go through those with you and explain what that argument is. And I'll tell you things about how I came to understand it in the way that I do, but I urge you to read the book yourself, because then you should understand it. I've learned a long time ago, being a teacher, it's not so important what I know, it's what the others, the students, learn. And that is an effort of theirs, not of mine. It's the reason there can't be an entitlement to an education. It's also the reason why a classroom is a very joyful place. I learn by teaching more than any other way, even though I mostly teach things that I've been studying for a long time. And that's because as they learn, they bring up things you never thought of, and they help you reason through them. And so I invite you to that undertaking. Also, there's a piece of good news, and that is, I'm pretty sure this is the only book like this. Lewis wrote more than 60 books. This book, which, as I say, is a kind of bridge between his popular and his academic writings, is the only book that he took the same point, he says, and turns it to fiction. So you get two chances to learn what he's got to say. He says in the preface to a book called That Hideous Strength, That Hideous Strength is the third in what's called the Space Trilogy. David Whalen, the provost of the college, who's an awesome fellow, you'll find out if you don't know it already, is going to talk about those. And I will talk about that last one a little bit. But he says in the preface to that, he says, this is a tall tale about devilry. And it makes a point, he puts the word point in quotation marks, that is the same as in my Abolition of Man. So you can read The Abolition of Man. I urge you to do that. And you can read That Hideous Strength. And then, if you're like me, you'll end up reading them both very many times. I read The Abolition of Man first in somewhere about 1975 or 6. It was assigned in a course by a very great teacher named Harry Newman, now gone. It was assigned in a course on modern philosophy. And he thought that this book was the most concise and vivid account of what's going on in modern philosophy. And I was surprised about that. Harry Newman, incidentally, was a self-professed nihilist. He said he believed in nothing. But never mind that. He was nonetheless a great teacher. He really knew how to take one through a book and figure out what it meant. And he was a student in that profound sense. He looked at what it meant. This is a point that's going to come up when we learn about Lewis and about how we learn. So I'll tell you a little bit about his life first. He was born in 1898 in Belfast, Ireland. He had one brother. His father was a solicitor. The Lewis family are actually of Welsh stock, which is one of the three parts of the main British island. But he was always fond of the Irish. And had a lot to say about them, and said that he really wouldn't want to live his life among any other people than the Irish, although he did, in fact, live his life among the English in Oxford and Cambridge. He had some very unhappy school experiences in his life. One school, they were abusive there, and not long after he left the school, the headmaster of the school was committed as insane. He would beat the boys. He served in the First World War. He was wounded. He wrote quite a bit about that. Was proud of his service. My teacher, Martin Gilbert, when he was a very young man, knew Lewis and also Lewis's friend, Tolkien. And he talked to them more than once about the First World War. It was, of course, a terrible experience. And yet, honorable too, and they saw it that way. Lewis was not a pacifist. Lewis was very smart. A key thing in his education was there was a man named Kirkpatrick who appears as a figure by the name of McPhee in That Hideous Strength. And he became, for a couple of years, I think it was, Lewis's private tutor. And that guy was a tremendous teacher. And Lewis was a tremendous student. He got first-class honors in Oxford in three subjects, classics and English, two parts of classics and one part of English, and that's very difficult to do. Not many people do that. And he was soon on his way to an academic career. After the war, Lewis became an academic. He got a professorship at Magdalen College. And he went on thereafter to have a great academic career, and also very long. It's worth saying that in the war, he met a man named Paddy Moore. They became very fast friends, and they made some commitments to each other. And because of those commitments, Paddy Moore was killed toward the end of the First World War. Paddy Moore's mother, Mrs. Janie Moore, basically became C.S. Lewis's care for decades, and he even waited on her. And a lot of people think that's an odd arrangement. He was living in this house with this older woman. He was a bachelor. His brother, Warney, lived there for quite some many years, too. But I think it's explained by the fact that he had this friendship, and he was a man of his word. He did the dishes. He waited on her quite a bit. And yet, somehow, he produced all this. When he was young, he lost his faith. He got it back in a very significant way. First, he decided that in 1929, he decided that he was a theist. That is to say, he believed in God, whoever that might be. And in 1931, he converted to Christianity. And in 1933, there appeared his first sort of Christian apologetic work, which is a retelling of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. It's called The Pilgrim's Regress. It's fun to read. I invite you to read all of these books. Lewis is famous, of course, for Mere Christianity and for the Space Trilogy and for the Narnia books and for the Screwtape Letters, which was a huge seller. And what that is a correspondence between a more senior servant of the devil and a young tempter on Earth who's got a client that he's working on. And it's one of the most powerful pictures of hell that you can ever read. And it's kind of funny. It's important to say about Lewis that Lewis was not a political man. He Christianity was first with him. And I make that point in saying that in the Screwtape Letters and in That Hideous Strength, hell looks a lot like a bureaucracy. And I personally think that Lewis meant that, but in saying a thing like that, I also have to tell you that, for example, we know that Lewis admired Winston Churchill, and they were contemporaries. In Surprised by Joy, a book both about Christianity and about meeting his wife, he married later in life to a woman who died a few years later of cancer, and that was grievous to him. If you lose someone, and you want to comfort, a grieved observed is Lewis's story of his grieving for his wife when he lost her. It's very worth reading. Lewis, was on the radio in the Second World War, and Churchill, when he was prime minister the second time, offered Lewis the Companionship of the British Empire, the CBE. And Lewis wrote a nice letter turning it down, which in paraphrase said, there are knaves who will say and fools who will believe that I am that my work is anti-leftist propaganda, and it's not, and so I must turn this down however much I respect you and grateful to you for this offer. In Surprised by Joy, he writes of Churchill, he calls him a great statesman. And he's making a point about how some people look like animals, and he says that Churchill looks like a frog. And there's also, and I never thought so myself. When I first read that, I thought to myself, he doesn't look like a frog. But then I will tell you that there's a photograph of Churchill, which you can find in any big picture book, photograph book of Churchill photographs. And he's giving a speech. It's called the Cannon Street Speech in the 1930s. It's about India. And the camera is below him, and he's got his specs on, and he's looking down at his paper, and the camera is below that. And he does look like a frog in that. So I think Lewis was an observant man. Also, we know from two letters that he wrote that Lewis was very glad when Churchill won the 1951 election and threw out the socialist. But never mind that about his politics, because remember, this is a man who adopted other purposes, and they were academic purposes and they were Christian purposes. And his actual claim in this book, The Abolition of Man, is that you won't get a thing like politics right if you don't know some deep things that make you into a fully good human being, which means a knowing kind of human being and an emotionally well-disposed kind of human being. A lot that goes on in Abolition of Man is about these connections between the emotions or the sentiments or the desires on the one hand and what you think on the other. And the reason the book is a little bit complicated is that that thing is a little bit complicated. But in my opinion, he explains it masterfully, and you can understand it better by reading this book. Lewis died in 1963 on the day that John Kennedy was shot. He died of natural causes. He had prostate cancer. And he was greatly mourned, although, of course, the attention was taken by the Kennedy assassination immediately. In 1947, Lewis had been on the cover of Time magazine as a great teacher of Christian things. So that's who he was, and you should start reading his books right away. And this book is one of the best books. To understand the book, as I say, there's just one argument that you have to learn. In the book, somehow it's a premise that a certain literature book teaches students that their sentiments are unimportant and arbitrary. That's the point, right? That the things they like and dislike, the things they admire or are repelled by, such things as that. That the teaching of this book is that those things are arbitrary and not important. And from that point, C.S. Lewis proves that if you follow that reasoning, humanity itself will be abolished. There will be the abolition of man. So you just have to follow that, right? There are three chapters in the book. The first one is called Men Without Chest. I'm going to talk about that one today. And the other two in the conclusion, or we may decide to do two conclusions because your instructor is slow. He apologizes for that. The second one is called The Way. Very important term. The Way. And the third one is called The Abolition of Man. And they make three parts of a single discrete argument. And I'll set the argument up for you. The book begins simply and charmingly. And I will tell you that here's what you may experience with the book, and I'm going to warn you against it and try to help you through it. First of all, it's very easy. They say about ancient philosophy that when you first read it, or let's start with modern philosophy, when you first read modern philosophy, it seems very complicated. And then you get it and you figure out, maybe there's not that much there after all. Ancient philosophy is the opposite thing. It's ordinary conversations. Plato's dialogues are, you say this, and you say this, and I say this, and I say this. It's just little arguments like you might have, right? And then you go on page after page, and you're in very heavy water, heavy weather, deep water. And so this book is a little like that. It's simple at every turn, but there are some transitions in it that matter, and the argument accumulates, so it's important to hold each part in your mind while you go. So I'll give you the beginning to start with. It's fun. Lewis says, I don't think we pay enough attention to elementary text. And for this reason, he says, I've chosen this text. He calls it the Green Book, written by two men he names Gaius and Titius. Now, these are fictional names, and he explains that. He says, I owe them good words for sending me a copy of this book for free, but I don't like this book. It's not good. And so I'm not going to use its real name. Its real name is known. We'll put it on the website if you want to, if you want us to. But it's a charity. He doesn't want to attack them by name. But he says, but I assure you that there is such a book and it sits on my shelf. So that's his footnote. His word as a scholar. And he says that the book, early in the book, they repeat a famous story. And Coleridge describes two tourists looking at a waterfall. And one of them says that the waterfall is pretty, and the other one says that the waterfall is sublime. Pretty and sublime. They're both good things, right? But sublime, that's a very good thing. And Coleridge says that he endorses the view of the one who says it's sublime, and he's disgusted with the view of the one that says it's pretty. So think of what a contrast there is between warming and agreeing to a thing with a thing and being disgusted by a thing. And so then Gaius and Titius go on to say, the tourists think, and so they're stating a third position between pretty and disgusting. The tourists think that they're saying something about the waterfall, but they're really only, and Lewis makes a lot of that word only, saying something about their own feelings. So in other words, you stand there at the waterfall. Have you ever seen a really great waterfall? Bet you have. You should. My favorite one that I've seen is in Yosemite Valley, one of my favorite places. And we have a photographer here who works very near where I'm standing right now named Doug Kuhn, and he loves to go there. He loves to go anywhere and take pictures. He's very good at it. Takes sort of art gallery quality pictures. And he especially likes to take pictures around this waterfall because there's something magical about the thing. Bridal Veil Falls are called. And when you go into this incredible valley and you look about yourself, that thing will command attention, and think what's there. El Capitan and Half Dome are both there too, and they're huge, massive, fantastic, awesome rock structures. Sublime, you might say. And so the book denies that there's a correspondence between the reaction in the tourist and these things outside, that their sentiments are mere sentiments, and that it's important for them to realize that. Now, Lewis talks about this a lot, and he says, first of all, they're not really making an argument that this is so, that your reaction to things, because remember, the opposite of thinking something sublime would be to think that something is horrific, say, for example, like watching somebody tortured, or watching, there's a great story in the Bible where David takes a pet, is it, I think? Because he loves the look of this thing. It's a lamb, maybe, I can't remember now. And he's got power, and so he takes it from the guy. But the guy loved it, and the guy had raised it. And the point of this story is to show that David had done wrong, and David is punished, corrected by the Lord for it. But you don't need to know that the Lord corrected him for it. You just need to know that thing was his, and he loved it, and had invested in it, and now it was taken from him. Well, if you regard that as injustice and are repelled by it, if that's only a sentiment in you, then what is the status of right and wrong? That's Lewis's question. Only saying something about their own feelings. So this correspondence between reality and the feelings, to break that, Lewis says, breaks something vital. He says, he describes the soul. And I'm going to venture into Aristotle here because I know Aristotle's writings about this pretty well, and because he's more explicit about this than Lewis is, he wrote a longer book about these subjects than Abolition of Man is long. And what Aristotle says is we have this soul and we have this body. And they're not two things, they're in integrity. A human being is a soul and a body. And the soul of the human being is a rational soul. That means it can For example, look at a waterfall and see that it's a kind of thing, that there are many others, and that this common noun waterfall applies to it, and that waterfalls in general can be a good kind of thing, but that some of them are really sublime. That's what rationality lets us do. Basically, it lets us use common nouns. Because think what a common noun is. We all have mothers and fathers or sons and daughters, right? And they're all, the sons and daughters are all boys and girls, and there are many boys and girls, but of course we love our own ones very greatly. And yet we see that they're also boys and girls, just like millions of others. And you never actually see the boy or girl. You never do get to see that, because if your boy was the boy, then there wouldn't be any other boy, because they're all different from each other. There must be something in them, some essence to them, that lets you see that they have that thing in common, and therefore you can put them in a category and make up a name for them, like boy, which is very different than Henry, my son, or Tony, my son, right? Henry and Tony are extremely well known to me, and of course very much beloved to me and my wife. But on the other hand, they're also boys. Actually, what they are is young men now. Always boys to me, though. And now that, you see, that faculty that's going on in the soul also makes possible us to have sentiments of admiration or distaste for things. And to say that those sentiments are not connected to reality is to say that the soul is not connected to reality. And the educational effect of that, which is really interesting, see, because here's another thing that goes on in us humans. It's not just that we can think, up, you know, imagine a pink unicorn, right? You all did. It's easy. You never saw a unicorn. You could imagine a pink unicorn with a green back and four horns, right? You can do anything with your mind. It's remarkable what you can do, right? Imagination is a very powerful thing. But on the other hand, it also dictates things to us. Because if we were a wolf, imagine yourself a wolf or a deer, to name two different parts of the food chain. So what wolves and deer do is that they do what wolves and deer do. They always do the same thing, right? Deer eat grass and run like heck when they hear something. Sounds like it might be a wolf. Wolves eat other critters. So they're all like that, right? And they face all the struggles of life. They can get hungry. They're in danger. Sometimes they're afraid. But that's all that's going on there. Whereas with us, there's some other thing, because we have all that too. We get tired. We have to eat. We have to sleep. We need things. We're afraid of danger. We're seduced by pleasure. We have all that just like animals have. But on the other hand, we're not dominated by it in the same way they are. And the reason for that is because we have this rational soul that lets us understand the good or the sublimity or the distastefulness or the evil of things. And those are categories that are separate from every individual thing and every individual action. And so what that gives rise to is a phenomenon we all know. At the end of the day, do you have a good think whether you did well that day or not? Do you ever have a day where you regret something you did? I do on many days. And, I get up in the morning and I try to do my best tomorrow. But it's amazing how often I don't quite get it right. And, I'm a reasonably successful fella. But I think a lot about, was this right? And that means that even when I've made a choice and committed myself to action, something inside us is talking to us and telling us, judging whether what we did was okay or not. And we're the creature that has that, right? And so there, now we've got these two things, right? We've got this conscience, which is grounded in some abstractions about right and wrong and kinds of actions and things. And we've got these bodily needs. And these bodily needs are just like the bodily needs in a wolf or a deer. What arbitrates between them? Lewis says it's in the chest, the seat of magnanimity. It's where, another word for it is spiritedness. It's the place where your firmest desires are set. Now, Aristotle claims that if we live our life right, it goes like this. First of all, we just start learning basic skills of human being human. At some point, we learn to talk. Nobody teaches us to talk, by the way. That's impossible. We learn to talk by hearing other people talk. There are teachers, but we're just listening. They're not really talking to us. We couldn't understand. We pick it up, right? But then along with that, we pick up lots of other things that will later reinforce observations of our own. For example, that a waterfall is beautiful, sublime. And you know, once you think something's sublime, a bunch of consequences follow from that. For example, be ashamed to dynamite it. Be ashamed to dam it up. Big thing to do that. Big step to take to do that. So, in an early step, after we learn the skills of operating like a human being, we start learning what's likable and not likable, what's good and what's not. And we have a natural sense of that, but especially when we're young, it's very open to persuasion. And so if you tell the young, and remember this green book by Gaius and Titius is a book for schoolboys and girls. If you tell them that those are just things inside themselves and they're not important and they don't correspond to anything outside yourself, then you have lost your way because you won't have this chest of high desire to lead you toward the right things and coordinate between your reason and your needs. Lewis says that the first step in this book is to bankrupt all of that. And also, it's just a logical extension of the argument, if the waterfall is not sublime, then how can anything be good? Because good is just a sentiment, just like, you know, it appears to us when we attach ourselves to it, just as a sentiment. And so Lewis, in the first chapter, takes this little book, this little sentence in this book, and he draws out what it means. And he says that this is characteristic of our time. Because what we're doing is we're making people vulgar, and we're reducing their sentiments just to their wants. We're making them more like the wolf or the deer. Whereas instead what you should say is like, so I ran into the current dean of faculty the other day, and he's an English prof, and he's really good. And he's always teaching Dante and Shakespeare and great stuff like that, Thomas More. And he's always full of it. He's always overflowing with it. And I sat in on a class one time, and here's how he started the class. And this is like my first class in graduate school started exactly this way about Aristotle's ethics. He said, have you read this book, to the students? And at Hillsdale College, when they hear that, if they haven't read the book, they feel ashamed. They say, oh, I should have read that book, you know. And he says, oh, you know, who's read it, you know? And he said, to you others, he said, I just want you to know, he said, I so envy you to be at the point of reading this book for the first time. This is a beautiful book. Not Shakespeare. It's not like reading cartoons. It's going to take some work. And so what motive would you have to do the work? If Smith is wrong and the book is ugly, that will soon reveal itself. You'll never be able to sustain it. Even Steve Smith, who's a very powerful guy, he could not sustain the idea for a lifetime that an ugly book was a beautiful book. Why did we read Shakespeare after all this time? 400 years? What's that about, you see? But the first thing you have to tell them is, I want you to befriend this book. I want you to come to know it because it will be good for you and it will make you happy. And I'm putting this down as an objective proposition, which you will never be able to sustain the belief in unless it's so. But on the other hand, you will never get in a position to make a judgment about it unless you start out with a will, with a chest full of desire to learn. That's C.S. Lewis's encapsulation of what's gone wrong with education. I'll close with a radical example of it. There's an AP, we have advanced placement courses in America, you probably know. And I think it's from 1999, so it may be out of date now, but there was a 1999 guide published by the College Board for teachers of AP English literature. And the preface to the guide was written by a professor from a liberal arts college in Georgia. And she tries to strike a balance in there. She says, you know, we used to, what we now call, privilege the text over the reader. And I think what that phrase means, she doesn't explain it very well, but I think what she means is she means doing what Steve Smith did in the Shakespeare class. But now what we know is objectivity and factuality are questionable. And so we try to teach the students to find their own reality in the text. Go look up the word reality and see what it means. And if it means anything at all, it can't mean everybody can have his own. And then she says, and we hope, she actually says a dangling participle, we hope that they will find values to guide them through a mad, mad world. So this suggestion that the sentiments that we supply to things are only internal phenomenon to us and unimportant is now much more explicit in English literature books than it was back then. In other words, the situation has gotten worse. And that means if C.S. Lewis starts this book with that one little sentence and says that it's going to lead somewhere very bad, well, it might be urgent to read this book today because we might be farther along the road toward what he predicted. And we'll find out what that is next time. Thank you for watching.